Last week we looked at the book of Judges. We began to look at the book of Judges. It was the first glimpse into a book that we don't study very often. Interestingly enough, then you might ask yourself, why do we even look at it at all? What could possibly be in a book of somewhat ancient history that would be of value to us? Some of the answers could be, well, why should we try to figure out, we should try to figure out why it's in the Bible? Why is this book in the Bible? What does it have for us? Certainly it has some historical data, some historical awareness, which could generally be beneficial. But is there anything more specific that we can learn from it? I say yes, there is. If we can identify mistakes of both individuals and the nation, we might be able to avoid making those same mistakes. Although it seems like our citizenry enjoys running headlong into mistakes of the past, so maybe this is not desirable to you, but I don't like to suffer that much, so I like to learn if I can. Possibly if we learn from mistakes, we can influence our culture with wise decisions that were different from their mistakes. A proper understanding of the Old Testament helps us understand the New Testament, helps us understand what Jesus is talking about, why he walked the earth, what difference those things make to us. For our study, we might be able to identify some of the ideas of revival, both on a macro scale, meaning within our culture in general, as well as in a micro scale, which means us personally. We can say, I don't need that, but if we are given a gift of knowledge and we don't use it, then we must learn solely from personal experience. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago, the idea of learning existentially. Is that all I am? Do I justify my existence through my experience, or is there truth, knowledge outside of my experience that helps me get through that? The problem is our fallen nature can lead us far from the answers God has for us. And we can be extraordinarily content with false information, especially if it gives us an emotional thrill that truth, even better than truth, gives. I've used this illustration before that I could carefully teach, or someone could be up here and carefully teach analytical truth on, and be correct on something. And when they were done, someone could stand up and give an emotional response opposed to that. And so often the emotional response would carry the day. Emotions are so strong in us. That's why music appeals to us. I heard this statement this week. Music begins where words leave off. And I think that's a nice way to say that. You know, music is a strong appeal to us. It has a strong appeal. Emotions have a strong appeal. We just need to make sure that those things are giving us a certain amount of truth. Things we learn from the book of Judges are not New Testament doctrine. It's not under the same kind of grace, although we saw that the Old Testament God was a God of grace. Do you remember that when we saw a couple weeks ago? He was not a God of works as he has claimed to be. He was a God of grace. This takes a lot of effort to get us to focus on who he is and who we are correctly. The stories do tell us, though, about the failures of men and women seeking to follow God. They give us a glimpse of God, and they give us a glimpse of ourselves. Remember last week we saw that these stories occur when the children of Israel enter the promised land. They have been wandering in the desert for 40 years. They are wandering because, I apologize for repeating some of this stuff, but some of us don't come every Sunday, and those of you that do, only half of you listen, so only a fourth of you are going to be bored with this. The other three-fourths, it'll be fine. No. And I don't want to take for granted that you know things that you don't, but I don't want to bore you either. So if this is totally catching up, I apologize if you've got it down, because I know many of you have the entire book of Judges memorized, right? No, but so anyway, I'll just take my best track through there, and hopefully you'll catch some new stuff if you can. But I understand that many of you know this book and have heard it before. Maybe we can find some new applications that might help. They're entering the promised land. They wandered for 40 years because at Kadesh Barnea, they refused to obey God. They refused to trust Him. This is where most of us in our spiritual walk start to dry up and die. When we understand what He would want us to do and we refuse to trust Him. It's so tempting to trust our own strength, right? I had a verse in my wall in my office for a long time about digging your own well and trying to create your own cisterns, which are actually dry. Within ourselves, we do not create a sustainable spiritual life. We have to rely on God. We have to get to know Him enough to define Him well enough to rely on Him. Joshua and Caleb were the two people of the 12 spies, remember, that did want to go in. And they were not able to because the group did not want to in general. 40 years they wandered. And remember I said that. You may be, they had to wander with the people who didn't believe, even though they did want to trust God for it. You may be stuck in a workplace, a family, or a friendship where not everyone will obey or even acknowledge God, but you can be faithful even if those around you are not, even if the struggle is long and painful. Remember last week we looked at, I had said we were going to look at the cycles in the book of Judges. There are 6 cycles, maybe 7, depending on how loosely you want to do it, but we're going to look at the 6 and 5 steps in each cycle, and they are clearly recognizable. The pattern is exact. So these steps are indications of the patterns of a nation, but also they indicate the tendencies of humankind in making its choices. So if you're with me, we moved briefly through the first couple of chapters. I'd like to move to Judges chapter 3. In these verses, if you've not read these verses before, there are some fairly shocking things in these verses to read. So I think we need to understand. One of the things that I've talked about before is when we fell in the Garden of Eden, and when you fell individually, most of us think we fell from here to like here. And we're a little bit bad. We have a little bit bad tendencies. We're not quite as good as we should have, or we should be. But I think if you read the Bible carefully and you look at its commentary on human nature when it says you are desperately wicked. I think desperately wicked means a little bigger than this, don't you? I mean, just a little bigger, like way down here. It doesn't mean that we feel, I mean, God loves us. He's good to us regardless of how we mess up. That's not because we went further down than we want to admit, doesn't mean He's going to have a bigger, He's not challenged by our failures. He doesn't look, I should pick on somebody here, but I won't. He doesn't look at whoever I might have picked on and say, wow, I can't redeem that person. It doesn't matter how I love those old, or I used to love them, I don't hear them very much anymore, the old unshackled things, if you remember those, you know, he's just like, because they were actual changes. They weren't pretend changes. You know, they were, the guy realized how far he had fallen, and he reached out to God, and God reached out to him, whichever way you want to spin that. They reached out to each other, and radical change came. Revival came. So in this verse, it says, these are the nations the Lord left to test all those Israelites who had not experienced any of the wars in Canaan. He did this to teach warfare to the descendants of Israelites who had not gained previous battle experience. And the 5 rulers of the Philistines, all the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Hivites, living in Lebanon mountains from Mount Baal to Hermon to Lebo Hamath, they were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which He had given their forefathers. The Israelites lived among these people in verse 5. And then it says they took daughters in marriage and gave their own daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. Now, this is an interesting thing. If you study the Old Testament, the New Testament, history since then, our present day behaviors socially, evil always seems to have the upper hand in terms of people's choices, you know? I mean, I think one of the reasons is it takes a lot more good, a lot more energy to do good than to do bad. Have you ever thought of that? I mean, you could build a friendship for years through hard labor and one harsh word, one harsh physical action, and it's gone. This building, this school started being built however many years ago. If you think of all the things that it took to build something for good, and we'll say this is for good, it took all the money that people had to earn to donate to build it. Every item in here is built from particles from all over the world, right? They had to make this and that. I mean, the amount of man hours, if you could add them up to build this whole facility, would be phenomenal. And myself, with 5 gallons of gas and a match, it can be gone like that. This is why God's task is so much greater than the devil's. Evil is easy. Being good is hard. That's why your task is harder than someone who pays no heed of God. Because you are struggling with absolutes, truth, trying to figure out what you should or should not do. The person who says, I'll just do what I want, I did it my way, that's pretty easy. Then we come to the cycle, the first cycle, and we're going to identify it. I told you last week, how many of you have more than one Bible? Okay. I won't make any comments about how often you read the one. No. See, I took a Bible and I just colored it. The cycles, I got like 5 different colored pens and I colored. It's not the Bible I use every day, but when I study Judges, it's the Bible I use. So the first color, and I always use kind of a red because that's bad. I don't know. If red's your favorite color, I'm sorry. So, no, it catches my attention that they're acting up here. It says, in verse 7, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. And they forgot the Lord, their God, and served the Baals and the Asherahs. These are the gods of those nations. It would seem to me that if the Israelite God was a legitimate God and a good God, and they portrayed him correctly, that he might be appealing to the local people who served gods that were brutal and beastly, and they had to sacrifice their children to them and things like that. But it seems like the appeal of these other religions were strong. This is where the worship of Baal and Ashtaroth began in earnest, and it continues to plague Israel until the Babylonian captivity, which we looked at a bit when we were looking at the book of Nehemiah. These were horrific practices. They are the natural result of sensual humanism. If you can think of that term in terms of sensual humanism, it's all centered in me. I'm my own measure. I don't have to be accountable to any specific God. It's how I feel about it. It's almost a type of humanistic existentialism. They are cruel, as humanism always becomes, and they license sensuality at the basis of levels. Remember, God has given them a law and a priesthood that they were to follow, not to prove their worthiness. That is not the goal of the law or the priesthood, but to show them their need for a reliance on God, but they don't follow it. The law is to help keep the tendencies of the nation of Israel in check. But they forsake this and they start to slide. And remember, we've used that word slide several times. They start to slide into idolatry. As I thought of this, I thought, what would be the Israelites' motto? That poor lady is coughing. Early childhood smoking. No, I'm not really. I'm seeking. See, where did that come from? I don't know. There's a bad side of me. This is why the rest. But see, I cough all the time up here, and you guys are very gracious to me, so I was glad to see somebody else there. I wasn't glad, really. But their motto seems to be, we will follow any God but the one who loves us. Now, is that not the most odd motto? We will follow the one who is mean to us. The Greeks did that, right? The Romans? Brutal gods that did terrible things to them, at least they thought. These people are following gods that make them sacrifice their children alive on red hot griddles. How is that a God to follow? I think our culture is doing the same thing in today's world. We will follow any God but the God who is good and the God who loves us and the God who is gentle with us. How can this be? How can we think and act this way? But it is the cry of our world today. I don't know how many of you know what the God of Baal was like. By definition, it means owner, master, lord, or husband. So it is something over you totally. It is giving the close personal relationship that the nation was to enjoy with God to a demonic practice. These gods in ritual demanded payment, allegiance, sensual satisfaction, and involved prostitution of both sexes, and often child sacrifice. These gods were believed to control the weather, reproduction, crops, and the physical and sensual areas of life. When I read, the more I read about that, I asked myself, how could you follow that? How could you choose that over even a weak definition of a biblical God who is good and cares for you? I don't know if you remember, and we need to look at this for a minute. When we talked earlier about gods residing in an area, not God, but people believed gods resided in an area. Do you remember this? They resided in a specific lake or a specific river, specific piece of ground. It was different than the God of the Bible that we believe in. We believe God is the God. He is omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent. You guys have probably heard these words, maybe not recently, but over time. Omniscient means he is all-knowing. He knows everything. Omnipresent, everywhere at the same time. Omnipotent, all-powerful. Now, if a God is to contain those three characteristics, how many of those gods could there be? One. Because only one God can be all-powerful. The children of Israel knew this. This is why they were to drive the people that had adopted these brutal, godless religions away. God knew their tendencies, how appealing these patterns would be to them. In Egypt, the people had adopted some of the Egyptian gods. We looked at that. We know that. They were comfortable with syncretism, the idea of mixing all ideas of faith and God together to come up with a happy medium that offends no one. They mixed gods of various religions into a happy, whatever makes you feel good religion. Mixing gods of all religions is still popular and will always be popular. It seems inclusive. It takes the most desirable elements of multiple faiths and let you pursue your own personal faith and practice. But if there is one all-powerful God, then we need to have our faith based on an infinite personal God. And if we don't, things get ugly fast because everything actually does become relative. Absolutes are gone. Relative truth reigns supreme. You can see when the children of Israel left Egypt, to a limited extent, they left Egypt's gods with the land. They remained in the land when they moved away from the land. Remember, we studied earlier the tendency to believe that God stays in that land. There are many illustrations of this in the Bible, and we're going to look at one. If you have your Bible, turn to 2 Kings chapter 5. 2 Kings is after. Second Kings chapter 5, with the story of Naaman. Do you guys remember the story of Naaman? Raise your hand if you remember the story of Naaman. A few of you do, some of you don't. Okay, so I'm going to have to read a few verses in order to just catch you up, but I'll read them pretty quick as I can read pretty quick, sometimes too quick. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Amram. He was a great man in the sight of the master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given victory to Amram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands from Amram had gone out and take captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, if only my master would see the prophet, and the prophet, by the way, here is Elisha, would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy. Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. By all means, go, the king of Amram replied. I will send a letter to the king of Israel. So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, with this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy. As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me? Obviously the king here is not paying attention to what he has in a good prophet of Elisha. When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him a message. Why have you torn your robes? Have the men come to me and he will know there is a prophet in Israel. So Naaman went with his horses and chariots and stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elijah sent a message to him. Go and wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan and your flesh will be restored and you will be cleansed. But Naaman went away angry and said, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand and call the name of the Lord his God and wave his hand over the spot and cure me of my leprosy. Are not the Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than any of the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed? So he turned and went off in a rage. See, he believes that there are gods in the water. And he's saying, our gods are as strong as in the water there as the gods are in the water here. And we'll confirm this as we move on. He says, Naaman's servants went to him and said, my father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more than when he tells you, wash and be cleansed? So he went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. So all of a sudden he thinks now that the God of the water of the Jordan is stronger than the God of the water where he comes from. And now let's look what he does. He does the oddest thing here that you would never understand if you didn't understand that they thought the gods were in the land and the water. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, now I know there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant. The prophet answered, as surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing. Apparently he wasn't a present day prosperity gospel teacher, was he? Because he had taken it all and more. And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. And this is the most interesting thing of this whole story. If you will not, said Naaman, please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry. He didn't want to plant a garden. This isn't why he wants earth. For your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. And then he talks about his personal responsibility. But the Lord, forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down and he is leaning on my arm, I bow there also. When I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. Go in peace, Elijah says. So Elisha acknowledges he has to be a good servant, but the person's heart isn't going to bow to Rimmon. Why did he want dirt? He wanted dirt that identified him with the God of Israel, not the dirt that identified him with the existing culture. And so I'm sure he went and spread that dirt out. When he bowed to pray, he knelt on that dirt. So this is how important it is for them. And the reason I bring this up is because the Lord is taking them, the children of Israel, across. And when they cross from the desert where they acknowledge that God was their God, they are now tempted to say that now we are working with a different set of gods because the gods are still in the land. Remember earlier we said it took a few days to get the children out of Israel, out of Egypt, but it took 40 years to get Egypt out of the children of Israel. And I remember saying that. But actually it took more than 40 years because they still haven't gotten rid of this tendency to be syncretistic in their ideas of mixing the God that they knew to be God with all these other gods around them. Their syncretism is still there. So when they go into the land, they fall right back into these bad habits that God had warned them against, that Joshua had warned them against. Verse 7, and the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served Balaam in the groves. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was hot against them, and he sold them into the hand of, and that is one long name if you're looking to that, Cushan-Rishathaim, something like that. We'll just call him the king of Mesopotamia, and the children of Israel served that king 8 years. So he gains dominance over them, something he was never to have. He gains dominance over them. So that's the second. First they sinned, and then they went into servitude. They were servants. And what's the next thing they do? If you remember, we had sin, servitude, supplication, salvation, and silence. I borrowed those from the walk through the Bible thing. They're all S's to make it easy to remember. So they cry out to the Lord in verse 9, and when the children of Israel cried to the Lord raised up a deliverer to the children of Israel who delivered them, even Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. And remember, Caleb was one of the two guys who had a strong faith. I believe that that faith was handed down to this younger relative. And verse 10, and the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel and went out to war, and the Lord delivered the king of Mesopotamia into his hand, and his hand prevailed against him. So here we have the salvation of Israel given to them. And then it says, and the land had rest for 40 years. 40 years, the same amount of time they wandered in the desert. So it's a lifetime of this responsible individual. This guy couldn't have been very old. He had to be under 20 at the time of Kadesh Barnea. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to go into the land. So he was young then. He lives in while he's alive. We talked about this last week, the tendency of groups of people to behave while somebody is strong to shepherd them. And why this is not what Christianity should be. Christianity should be strong because each individual develops a strong relationship with the Lord personally and is basically immovable except for by the Lord's Spirit just through the pressure of the world to make them change. And the land had rest 40 years, and Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. You think they learned a lesson as a nation? Look at the next verse right there. And we're not going to go into that verse till next week, but we'll just read it. And the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of the Lord. And so you know what's coming. The next cycle's coming. We have to be careful when we define God and what he wants of us. Their idea of some sort of syncretism idea that God was all of the things of all of the gods that were in their area was not correct. God was very specifically defined, and he had given them that definition more clearly than any other nation. The world in evil urges us to slide away from that biblical definition now. And that seems okay for a time because we're still anchored in the actions that result from that definition. But as we slide, eventually, our absolutes are gone. Everything becomes relative. Sometimes this slide appeals to us because it seems progressive in an oddly wrong way. Well, I'm not as narrow-minded. I'm not as judgmental. I'm not as this or that. And part of that is because we have adopted with our faith additional stuff that God didn't intend us to apply brutally to those around us. But part of it is just because our flesh wants to run to freedom. Freedom apart from God, where we can be our own measure and make our own definitions of what God would have us do. If we move into these definitions as the children of Israel did in this first cycle, it leads to destruction, both for ourselves and then our families and then our culture. So the answer for us is simply return to the definition of the God of the Bible, the infinite, personal, omniscient, omnipresent, an omnipotent God who is absolute. Or more simply said, you must simply follow the God who loves you. God, you are good to us, and I thank you for loving us. Help us to learn from these stories as much as we can so that we can honestly reflect you to a world who is in desperate trouble. Thank you again. In Jesus' name, amen.